Coming up, a community forum from WRVO and the Innovation Trail.
We can't live without water.
It'll just create more jobs all around and more economic development.
A few thousand jobs for 5 to 7 years. After that, what's next?
This is an important transition to a renewable future.
Housing has become very expensive.
My children and my grandchildren, they're just not going to be able to enjoy the same things that I enjoyed.
Is the project justified? Is it needed? What are the alternatives to it?
We have to start looking at this global planet. Your power is not coming from your switch on the wall.
So where does power come from? And what are the economic and environmental costs of powering our homes and our jobs? Join us as we follow the power lines. Welcome to the Innovation Trail's Innovation Conversation. I'm WRVO's Emma Jacobs. Today we're coming to you from SUNY Oswego's Metro Center in downtown Syracuse for a conversation following our power lines to find out what's powering our home and our jobs. And we're actually going to start out with a conversation with Jeff Brady. He's a national correspondent for NPR, an energy reporter. And he wasn't able to be with us today, so what we're going to do is play a pre-recorded conversation from last week. What ideas do you hear as an energy reporter that people would like to see in our energy mix? What's the dream, the ideal?
I think it's clear the dream is 100% renewable energy. I mean, that's the ideal that's always out there, and few people really oppose it. You know, nice mix of windmills and solar panels, maybe a few hydroelectric dams in there and geothermal projects thrown in, all, you know, providing the amount of energy that we've become accustomed to, all the upsides and none of the downsides that fossil fuels have, you know, the greenhouse gases, oil spills, and pollution. So we'd get all the things we'd like. We'd be able to drive around anywhere we want, when we want, keep our homes and workplaces nice and comfortable with heating and air conditioning, but without any of those downsides. But it's really not the direction that we're headed in. You look at any educated prediction of what the world's energy mix is going to be 10, 20, 50 years down the road, and all the bad boys are still in there. You see coal, oil, natural gas, of course, that's playing a bigger role as time goes by. And it's a little better because less pollution, but still it's a fossil fuel and extracting it is clearly a problem. And renewable energy starts to show up in these graphs as a little sliver, and it grows rapidly, but for a long time, it's still just a sliver. And I've seen plans for, you know, transitioning the U.S. to 100% renewable energy in a short amount of time, but you really can't do it without sort of fundamentally restructuring our culture. And you'd have to launch an effort even more extraordinary than what the country did in World War II with lots of centralized control of resources. And it's really just not something that people are going to accept right now, I suspect.
Are there things that we're doing that will begin to move us towards that change?
You know, there has been a lot of progress. I think the states really led with some of these renewable energy standards around the country, requiring utilities to get a certain percentage of their electricity from renewable sources. And, of course, the federal government has invested billions in encouraging renewable forms of energy. And how many times have you heard President Obama mention renewable forms of energy in his speeches? There is a healthy, growing, and dynamic renewable energy industry that is developing in the U.S., wind and solar are seeing double-digit growth each year, but it takes time. And I think a lot of us don't really understand how huge our energy infrastructure is and what it takes to change it. ExxonMobil, the largest oil company out there, brings in $420 billion a year. That's more than some countries, and it's just one oil company. So converting that huge energy infrastructure takes time.
And when you're reporting on continuing efforts to harvest fossil fuels, what do people tell you they expect? Do they think they'll be shutting down?
Well, you know, think what you will about the folks in the energy industry, but it includes some of the smartest people around, and they know their business, and most will admit that in the long term, fossil fuels are a finite resource and that something else is going to emerge. But they're also pragmatists, and they know the way that the world works right now, and they get frustrated by the idea that we can sort of flip a switch and all of a sudden we're 100% green, you know, overnight. And in some way, it minimizes what they've built over decades, really, which is an extraordinary infrastructure that a lot of us have the privilege of taking for granted. And so they, in the end, they tend to go on about their business, you know, harvesting fossil fuels and investing in potential renewable resources for the future, actually both renewable and dirty ones, and assuming that a growing world is going to need a lot of energy, and they're going to provide it and make some money off of it in the process.
What things are shaking up the energy sector right now?
You know, I think the biggest thing that's shaking up the energy business right now, and you don't hear it put this way very much, but it's really outsiders getting involved in the business, you know, because you've had these smart people in their bubble for a long time. They've kind of gotten used to their way of doing things. But now you've got politicians and filmmakers and everyday people getting involved in energy policy making. And I think that makes some of them uncomfortable. And the industry certainly isn't used to this. But, you know, you've got all kinds of people who don't trust those folks within that bubble anymore. They want to offer them advice. So in addition to their regular work of going out and extracting fossil fuels, now they've got to think more about all these other people getting involved in their business. So you see all these commercials on television and in radio from the oil and natural gas industries. And you're also going to see, I think, a big presence in the election next year. A lot of folks very upset in this industry with President Obama and people in Congress who they don't really consider friends, and they're going to be very active in that election.
In a recent story, you said, to some extent, fracking has become a distraction. And I think you meant that in terms of other things involved in gas drilling, like air pollution, but are there other policies and issues that get left by the wayside with the focus on very visible issues like gas drilling?
You know, I think what's been left behind is perspective. And I think both the industry and its opponents are to blame for really focusing the country's attention on fracking itself. I think it's an easy thing to organize politically around because the word sounds vaguely naughty and the concept is easy to grasp, or relatively easy to grasp. But what gets lost is an accurate perspective. And I think we have two big things going on here. First, fracking has huge benefits to all of us. Our utility bills right now are lower than they would be otherwise because fracking has given drillers access to natural gas and increasingly to oil in this country that otherwise was off limits. And that's increasing supply and keeping prices down. But fracking has also made drilling possible in places where people live. And some of those people are being hurt by having dirty industrial processes occurring near them. It's not just the fracking fluids that are the problem. It's the air pollution and it's the waste that gets dragged up from underground and stored in different places, and sometimes it leaks out. Even down to people's lives being disrupted in these peaceful towns, or once peaceful towns, where you've got huge convoys of trucks driving around now. It seems to me the question is, how will all of these people benefiting from the increasing production of gas and oil in the U.S. help those who are hurt by increasing production? And that is where I think the distraction is. A few people are hurting right now, and they're getting very little help.
If you're just joining us, this is the Innovation Trails Innovation Conversation in Syracuse. Today, we're following the power lines to talk about our energy mix and where our power will come from in the future. Now joining me to continue our discussion are Andrea Feldpausch-Parker, Assistant Professor in Environmental Communication at SUNY's College of Environmental Science and Forestry, Jim Stapleton, Manager of Energy Efficiency for National Grid, and Pete Wilcoxon, he's an Associate Professor and Director of the Maxwell School Center for Environmental Policy and Administration at Syracuse University, and a Brookings Institution Senior Fellow. Pete Wilcoxon, I wanted to actually start with you. Does that world that Jeff described, with fossil fuels still in the picture for a long time and you know, slow incremental change, does that sound like what you see ahead?
Unfortunately, I think the answer is absolutely yes. And I think the reason, I just emphasize what Jeff was talking about, is that turning over the energy generation mix is a very, very expensive proposition. To replace the fossil fuel generating capacity in electricity alone is, if you could do it overnight, a $2 to $3 trillion cost. And for comparison, that's the entire investment budget for the United States for a year, and about 100 times the amount the electric power industry usually spends new capital. So it's a very expensive proposition to replace all of that overnight.
You know, before we resume our conversation, I wanted to play you a clip that came from some reporting we've been working on leading up to this program. And actually, we were looking at Canadian hydro imports and this planned dam way up north in Canada. So the person you're about to hear is George Russell, and we may have to come back to the discussion on him, but he's an environmental coordinator for the Nunatuqavik, which that's one of the local First Nations.
What's this power going to be used for? Is it really going to contribute to climate change, or is it going to take away? For example, given people in New England, Nova Scotia, more capacity for their air conditioning, their refrigerators, I really don't think that this is the solution to climate change.
I think it's a common concern. This is what I want to put to you, is it's a common concern, I think, that some of the new sources we're looking at, like energy, natural gas, some big hydro, that could delay some of the hard choices we do have to make, because I think, as you were saying, that transition is very slow. So what choices do we have in the meantime, I think, is the question, and how do we make sure that we're not just adding to those wasteful habits? And I wanted to put that to you, Pete, and also to you, Jim Stapleton.
Well, I think these new renewable resources coming online, not only large hydro, but also new wind farms and solar, are all steps in the right direction. And as time goes on, what they will largely do is replace coal-fired generation, and that will be a step forward in reducing climate change. Coal is nationally the largest source of electricity, and it is by far the most dirty in terms of both conventional air pollution and climate change. So anything that we can do that reduces coal-fired electric power will be a step in the right direction.
And I think there's many factors that need to be considered in this topic. I think everything, the comments that were talked about were very good and favorable. Some of the things I look at from a utility perspective is, where does the renewable energy go? There has to be interconnects onto our system. So it's kind of like when we have wind farms or we have solar farms or we have any kind of renewable energy or any kind of energy generation on our system, there is a cost to it. So there's investors who do these things. They're private sector companies, generally speaking, who are looking to do something that may make a whole lot of sense. And the issue is we have to get that power onto our grid, and we have to move that power to where it is needed. So in the case of New York State, a lot of our power goes downstate to New York, and so we have losses on the line and a lot of things that come into play. So I think it's a complex issue. It's not one-dimensional by any scope of the imagination, and I think there's a lot of other things, from cost to location to energy efficiency, and what's the cheapest thing we can do today to not produce that kilowatt hour.
Can I just add to that?
You know, we're going to come back to this in 1 second, but we got to take a break. You're listening to the Innovation Conversation. I'm WRVO's Emma Jacob. I'm WRVO's Emma Jacobs, and this is the Innovation Trails Innovation Conversation at the Metro Center in Syracuse. And with me today, Andrea Feldpausch-Parker of SUNY's College of Environmental Science and Forestry, Jim Stapleton of National Grid, and Pete Wilcoxon of the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. And you were going to continue on that point.
Yeah, I just wanted to emphasize what Jim just said about the importance of transmission. This is something that people don't often think about, but it's a major bottleneck in getting renewable resources, getting the electricity from renewable resources to the markets where it's needed. Transmission congestion now in New York State causes, during the summer, electricity prices in New York City to be as much as twice to three times the cost of electricity outside the city, and that's just because we can't get the power in. And as a result, to meet the needs of people running their air conditioners and so on in the city in the summer, a lot of natural gas plants have to run near the city, and if we could build more transmission and bring in renewable power from outside, we could cut down on those emissions. It's very hard to site power lines, though.
It seems like transmission is sort of a wild card in this, that it's not very visible. We don't think about it a lot, but it seems like it's having a lot of impact. You know, and how is that something that we address and build some, you know, energy and momentum around?
I think the answer to that is again, fairly complex. In New York State, we have probably the most optimum situation would be to have on-site generation, if we could store energy or package energy, if we could have it close to where it's needed. Obviously, in New York State, the capacity issues reside south and southeast of like Albany and down, heading down towards New York. So there are losses on lines just through power line losses that we have. So I think part of it is what is the cost of energy entering the grid? How far does it have to travel? And what are the losses associated with that? And there's cost to all of the generators to do this. So I think it's one of these things that things need to be specifically identified as it's a renewable source and where does it go. And I think we got to look at the costs associated with it. New York State has right now, including the supply and delivery, some of the highest energy costs in the United States. So if we look at the economy and looking at manufacturing and all of the things that we talk about that we've lost in New York State, we're trying to find ways to have manufacturers and to have business return to New York State and to be competitive with the other states with electricity prices, because customers don't look at it as just a supply side or just a delivery side. They look at it all in. They take an energy cost per square foot, or they take an energy cost on a monthly basis or annual basis, and that's what we've got to compete against. So again, it's kind of a business decision, but I think all of these things that we're talking about go far deeper than just a renewable source. I think they have to be specific to what is it going to do, where is it going to do it, and what does it do to the cost overall, to the price of the commodity on the grid at any given point in time.
Okay. Andrew, I wanted to bring you in here because, I mean, when we're talking about transmission line, that's absolutely something the neighbors notice. What do you think we can do, you know, to be aware of those impacts, the social and environmental ones, and to try to ameliorate those impacts?
I think that we're getting better at kind of having those conversations the more that we put energy at the forefront of, you know, the issues that we have to deal with. I think that we're better at kind of being able to communicate the issues that are associated with it.
I mean, people who live around energy projects, what are the sort of things that come up for them when there's something new or something that's a big project? You know, what do they have to think about? And what do you find that people say to you about what they're noticing and, you know, whether they're willing to put up with the cost to get the benefits?
I think in a lot of siting issues, you have communities that are potentially more used to being in areas where these place, you know, these transmission lines or whatnot are going to go through. And so there's some familiarity maybe with the industry, but not necessarily the ramifications that are associated with it. So when you talk about, you know, dealing with transmissions or anything along those lines, the health impacts and things like that, those communities may or may not be aware of what's going on, you know. But communities that have never been exposed to, you know, having to have a pipeline go through their property or transmission lines, things along those lines, that's a new experience, and they're going to feel more threatened at the possibility of what that means to them from a health perspective and what that means about having a transmission line, you know, going over their house or past their house. So I think that there's a level of, you know, familiarity that can occur, not necessarily knowing the impacts of what that brings to a community.
So it sounds like you're saying that people make decisions, you know, based on information or perception, but maybe not the whole deal.
Yeah, I don't think that a lot of areas have all of the information in order to kind of be able to determine, you know, is this, I think that there's oftentimes kind of fears of the unknown, but how do we get all of the appropriate information to somebody? How do they gain access to the appropriate information for knowing if there's health risks associated with, you know, where they're living and things, you know, things like that. So I think that it's having the resources to gain access to that information and then to kind of understand fully what you're potentially being exposed to.
I think just to jump in, I think this goes back to something that Jeff Brady mentioned in his introduction to this session, that a lot of these big infrastructure projects have a lot of beneficiaries who live a long way from where the project is actually located. So when we build a very large power line, say to bring power from Canada down to New York City, it has to run through a lot of people's backyards. And it benefits people in New York City a great deal, but it doesn't necessarily benefit the people whose neighborhoods it runs through at all. And so I think taking seriously how we compensate and help the people who are the bystanders in these large infrastructure projects is a really important thing. It's very important because if they're not on side, often these local communities can block these projects.
We're going to come back to this, but I want to ask one more question on the decision-making side of this to you, Jim Stapledon. It seems like we still have a long way to go on conservation. I'm wondering, what if it is cheaper, why are we not seeing more people, you know, more broad-scale changes made in that direction?
I think people, residential and businesses, need to focus on efficiency right now, and I'm going to put a plug in for it, but there's never been more money in the state of New York for energy efficiency programs residentially or on the business standpoint. In New York State, I manage an over $75 million budget for incentive programs to the ratepayers in New York State. And everybody in this room probably, if you look at your bill, you pay a system benefit charge. So we're paying into these programs. And data shows that it takes 4.6 cents to run a program to save a kilowatt hour. And most things out there that we talk about cost more than 4.6 cents to produce that kilowatt hour, regardless of what the fuel source is. So if I take the fuel source plus the delivery and put it into that house, and you look at a kilowatt hour price being somewhere for a residential customer about 12 to 13 cents, plus we have the carbon impacts and the sustainability issue, it's 4.6 cents. And we're all paying into the system benefit charge as New York State ratepayers. So it makes sense if we really want to save the kilowatt hour to use less, do the things in our house to give us a better quality of life, whether it's lighting, weatherization, heating in businesses, whether it's air conditioning, indoor air quality, all of the things that can affect not only energy issues but health issues. It is presently the cheapest way to go when you look at everything all in. And also when you look at the regulators in the state of New York, we've just received a month ago programs for 2012 through 15. So when you look at the programs that we have, they're energy efficiency in nature. They're going to be lighting and heating and cooling and all of the systems that you have in your house and businesses. But the point is that's going out to 2015. I think it's going to be energy efficiency will be a segue into smart grid and smart houses. So in other words, you'll have the ability to turn things off in the middle of the day, and we'll have the, you'll agree to something that you'll be compensated for, that the utility will do something to take a load requirement off their system, but at the same time save energy for you. So that's looking out for the next 3 or 4 years. And plugging energy efficiency, I think we need to move forward with all of the issues that we've talked about and the renewable and some of the other issues. Cost got to come down on that equipment, because I tie this in also to cost and also manufacturers and technology. And where are we with technology issues as it relates to the equipment that allows us to do these things, and also what's the cost to do that? So I think there's a lot of things. I think energy conservation and efficiency, as we are all paying into it, take advantage of the opportunities that your utilities and NYSERDA can offer you, because you're paying into them and it's the best way to go right now and enhance your quality of life.
Can I back you up there? You said there's a lot of money in the pot for conservation. Do you think people are taking advantage of it to the extent that they could? You know, is a big box retailer, for example, you know, converting every single one of their stores because they've got lots of fluorescents and air conditioning. You know, are people doing it and making those decisions?
No, but if you look, when you look at a business decision, if you look at the big box stores and you go into any of them, you know, I'm the only guy who walks in and looks up at the lights in these places, and people stop me and say, what's wrong with you? You're looking up. But I look at the lights, I look at things, look at the big box stores and the things they've included. They have night setbacks, they have dimmable ballasts. On sunny days, lights are off. On cloudy days, lights are on. They've done all the things that allow them to sell things at much cheaper prices than other people who don't do anything, because energy is a big cost to their overall operations. So when you look at the big box stores, it's kind of like they are getting better. They are reducing their cost per square foot, where the person that says, I'm going to do nothing, is going to face nothing but higher costs on products moving forward. So they need to take advantage of this. On the residential level, We could do far better. We have a lot of participation on our heating programs. Why? Because obviously we have upstate New York winters. But I think when we look at weatherization, we look at insulation opportunities in our houses, we do blower door testing, we look at a lot of things that are out there. We penetrate the market about maybe 20 to 25% with a lot of our programs. That means 80% of the market goes, they can't be bothered. And I often say that there's, you know, a third of customers have done everything. A third of customers will never do anything because they can't be bothered. So we're looking at about a third of customers that through outreach and education, through the efforts of everybody in this meeting tonight and all of the things that the utilities do and NYSERDA does and everybody does, energy's everywhere. I think one of the things is that there's a lot of energy information out there and a lot of people are confused as to which way to go. Everywhere you turn, there's a program, there's an opportunity, there's money. But at the end of the day, I think it's a very busy radar screen for energy, and people need to sort of step back. But there are resources out there to give you some direction, and there certainly is some incentive money. Many of our programs are paying up to 50 cents on a dollar for retrofits. So that means I know people that have gotten an $8,000 insulation project on their home, and they're getting a $4,000 grant. So I would say clearly participate in the programs and take a look at it, and there's a lot of resources for you to try to educate you as to which way to go.
I want to ask one more question I'm hoping you can follow up on briefly. I guess the question would be, you know, if you're a big box store versus if you're a homeowner, how are people making these big choices versus small choices? What is the time and energy involved, and how is that affecting, you know, what people do in terms of conservation?
Most of the big box stores have an energy manager, so they have a full-time energy manager that's sitting there and kind of looking at this on a daily basis. They look at seasonal differences. They look at the buildings that they're in. If you look at a lot of the big box stores, they don't move into an existing business that's been closed down. They move into a new building because they want to build that prototype store exactly to their standards, looking at heating, cooling, and lighting and everything. I think part of the problem people don't move forward is because a lot of people don't have the expertise at their fingertips to move forward as far as somebody who's knowledgeable to say, here's the applications within my business or my home that I want to move. And before you call a vendor, in my opinion, to do any work in a business or home, you should sort out, this is what I want to do. A lot of people go to lighting initially because it's aesthetically pleasing and it's the first thing customers see. But I think if you look at overall energy use on a per unit basis, a lot of things that are in the mechanical room, the boilers, the air conditioning units, we have more need for air conditioning than ever with computers and our servers and everything there. People need to be able to sort of set a business game plan. I call it identify projects that you would like to do. Sort through them, do a cost-effectiveness test, do your payback and business case, but I think that's the best way to prioritize and say, you know, give yourself an energy report card and how are you doing in your business or home, and if you need to make changes, focus in. They may not be the least expensive things, but I think they're going to be the things, if you're in it for the long haul, that are going to be most cost-effective for you.
I also think that, so I just recently had an energy audit done in my house and realized how much it is seeping energy. But I think that by having something like an energy audit done, it really helps you put things in perspective of, you know, what to tackle first and what can, you know, be left for a little while longer. When moving into an old house, you think this is great. You know, I'm not building a new house. I'm not, you know, adding its own carbon footprint. But you have to think about things like insulation and how your windows are doing and things like that. But by having the energy audit, you know in what order you can do these improvements. And I think that helps you budget out what you can do, because a lot of us don't have a lot of free money around. So we have to kind of tackle the jobs that are the most realistic. And like Jim said, you know, the lights are often first, because it's something that, you know, we can obviously, it's easier to change a light bulb than it is to have insulation blown into a room, you know, things along those lines. So I think that in order to have a realistic idea of how to make these improvements, you need to take that extra step on having the energy audit. But then that's also knowing that there's programs in existence and being exposed to those programs to help you figure that out. And I just happened to kind of stumble across a free energy audit when I went to a 350.org rally. And so I don't think otherwise I would have known that this program was available to me. So I think that there's, you know, not fully knowledge of what's available to the public. And maybe more people would take advantage of it, especially when you attach that word free. in front of it.
I'm hearing a lot of, you know, it's dollars and cents sort of motivation here. And I know you've spent a lot of time on a pretty interesting example that sort of lays out, you know, the moral equation. And this was experiments with carbon capture in the Southwest. And, you know, the central question there is really, it's climate change and it's, you know, some bigger picture things. And I'm wondering for people, you know, living on top of these cavities where essentially, you should probably explain this, but the carbon is sucked in, stored underground. You know, what are the factors that weigh when they reach a decision?
So carbon capture and storage, the aspect that I was looking at was the storage of CO2 in underground formations. And I think that what goes into the decision-making process, at least for the communities that are potentially impacted, this is going to be an opportunity for us to store CO2 because it's not being, you know, it's not allowed to make it to the atmosphere. So we're decreasing the amount of CO2 that could be contributing to climate change. But the problem is, what does that mean for residents in these communities where they're storing the CO2 underground? And so is there a potential for leakage or any other negative impacts to the community that they have to worry about? And so there's a lot of communities who don't know that this is going on. So when it comes to decision making, that's occurring somewhere else. That's not necessarily occurring at the community level because of a lack of knowledge and the fact that it's still in the research and development stage. So I think that will come into play later on.
You're listening to the Innovation Conversation. I'm WRVO's Emma Jacobs. I'm WRVO's Emma Jacobs, and this is the Innovation Trails Innovation Conversation at the Metro Center in Syracuse. We're here with a studio audience following the power lines to discuss energy in New York State. And on our panel, Andrea Feldpausch Parker of SUNY ESF, Jim Stapleton of National Grid, and Pete Wilcoxon of the Maxwell School Center for Environmental Policy and Administration at Syracuse University. Andrea, I wanted to come back to something you were talking about earlier. You've done this research on carbon capture in the Southwest, and I'm wondering, do the words climate change come up? Do people put that on the table, say, my backyard versus the big picture?
Yeah, and when it comes to carbon capture and storage, it's actually, they'll refer to it as under my backyard. Their version of NIMBY is NUMBY, not under my backyard. You know, this is still a relatively new technology that hasn't even been deployed. So in my research, when it comes to carbon capture and storage as a potential mitigation strategy for climate change, I think that there's a lot of people that have different feelings and ideas about it. There is, you know, obviously still some very present climate skepticism that we're experiencing. But where there may be climate skeptics, I think that pollution issues are very much accepted all around as being an issue related to energy. There's also some, you know, even if there's skepticism about climate change, there's other reasons that people are looking at carbon capture and storage. In Texas specifically, climate change may be the dirty word, but CO2 emissions is perfectly acceptable in dealing with those emissions because carbon capture and storage would allow for the continuation of the use of coal and the ability to extract more oil and gas resources because of the process of injecting CO2 into these underground formations, which is used to retrieve oil and gas. And so I think that even though it's put forth as a climate change mitigation strategy, there's arguments that go outside of climate change that are used to kind of push forward this technology.
I actually want to play another clip here, and this comes from a story that my colleague Ryan Morgan and I reported back in 2010, looking at two separate wind farm projects, actually, and one which was still under review, and the other where residents' opposition had actually killed this plan to site wind turbines on these farms, and this is in East Meredith, New York, and you're going to hear the town supervisor and a couple who live there, Ron and Sue Bailey, were sitting on the Bailey's front porch.
Natural gas and wind power, they're alternatives to each other. I mean, it seems tricky to oppose the gas drilling and oppose the wind, you know, but be really right. For alternative.
I'm for solar power.
It's hydro fracking.
I like water.
Yeah.
And that's very serious.
So there's a lot of conflict about what energy we do want, and I'm wondering, I think I almost want to put this to all of you because this is something I think a lot of people have thoughts about. Do we back ourselves into a corner on energy? Or do the things that should win out, do they win out, despite the disagreement?
I think that the first thing that we have to realize is that any type of energy source has its costs associated. With wind, you know, we have to deal with the fact that the wind isn't blowing all the time. There's intermittency issues and other risks associated with solar. It's not always sunny. So how do we deal with, you know, these short bursts of energy, and how do we deal with the storage of that energy? Also, you know, think about wind turbines. What is that going to do to our migratory bird and bat populations? These aren't perfect technologies. None of them are. And so I think that we have to kind of figure out which, you know, energy sources are going to work for us in what amounts that we can, you know, how much energy we can get from every source. But I think you can't say that anyone's perfect, but it's what risks we are willing to accept. How much energy are we willing, you know, is it possible that we can get from these resources? And, you know, these are just some of the things that you have to take into consideration. They're not all perfect.
Realistically, I think the best way to think about it is that we need a mix of all the different sources that are currently on the table so we can have more wind. But contrary to what was just played in the clip, wind and gas actually go together well, because gas is one of the things that can be brought online when wind drops off due to a drop in the wind power. The same is true with gas and solar. If we have a lot of solar deployed and it's less sunny, we need to bring something online because at the grid scale, with current technology, demand and supply have to be matched in real time or else the lights go off. For the foreseeable future, the way that I think about it is we're going to have a mix of technologies, and the question is trying to steer the mix in the right direction.
Who does that math? How does that math happen?
Well, right now, as far as the electric grid is concerned, depends on what part of the country you're in. In places that are largely deregulated in the wholesale level, like New York, different companies can build generating capacity and then sell it into the market through the independent system operator. Other parts of the country are still regulated, and the power plants are built by local utilities. So at the moment, it's what's most profitable that gets online.
And how do we encourage this sort of long-term decision-making, careful thinking about what we do want in the long term?
Well, the single most effective thing for steering the economy away from fossil fuels would be a tax on carbon or carbon dioxide emissions. If we want to move away from fossil fuels, that's absolutely the first thing to do. The problem that makes fossil fuels so important in our economy is that they're inexpensive. And if that is undesirable and we want to move toward renewables, we're going to have to gradually raise the cost of those fuels.
It sounds difficult.
Politically, it is very difficult.
And I think that's also, you know, where some of the issue of, you know, passing climate legislation, it would hopefully move us to renewables, but it also would mean that it'd make our fossil fuels potentially more expensive if we put the legislation through, because they would need to use technologies such as, you know, different carbon capture technologies, which require energy in themselves.
Can I just add one thing before it slips away? When you think about raising the price of fossil fuels with a carbon tax or something like that, please keep in mind that that money does not disappear from the economy. It could be used for curing the federal deficit to some extent or reducing other taxes. It is a very, very important resource that we have available.
So it sounds like there's a lot of different factors that play in. And again, it sounds like there are no easy win-wins, I'm hearing. We spoke about this a little bit earlier, but while it makes sense that you put power projects where, you know, for example, a nuclear plant next to a city of 8 million is not a popular thing, and, you know, to some extent it makes sense to put things where fewer people are impacted. Fact is that people in urban centers are going to get a lot more of that power. What are the impacts of that? What things need to be built into the process to make that an equitable system?
Well, for sure, we have to have very good public participation processes in how those things are sited. That's a thing which, for example, the EPA has a lot of experience in doing when dealing with, say, Superfund sites for getting public input. And there has to be real money on the table to help out the people who are hurt by these projects. If the project makes sense to go forward, that's because it produces benefits that exceed its cost. And if that's the case, means that we should be able to compensate the people who are paying those costs wherever they happen to be.
I also think that having technology advance and having on-site generation for businesses, so there is no delivery, there is no losses. So in other words, a power plant exists on the site where the actual kilowatt hours themselves or gas are going to be used. So there is no losses across the system. It's going to be, and so part of that's energy storage. Part of that is better on-site generation. We got CHP projects now, combined heat and power projects, which are taking off exponentially across our big customers' facilities. So there's a lot of things there to try to put that generation on site. CHP is probably one of the most, I'll say one of the best things that have hit large industrial customers. What people need to do is work with the regulators to get these kinds of technologies into tariffs. So which is tariffs are basically the contract between utilities and customers in the state of New York as to what they pay and how easy or not easy it is to build these things. So there are some opportunities, and those will only advance as technology improves.
Andrea, I want to put this to you one more time in this way. You know, are there ways in the process of siting and, you know, figuring out what we're going to do that people can step in on, or that there are better ways to make space for people to?
Yeah, I mean, there's opportunities during, you know, permitting process and things like that. But when we talk about, you know, actual, like, true public participation, that doesn't happen very often. It just doesn't. Because in order for people to fully feel like they are involved, they have to have something more than just a comment period. And when that's their homes, you know, that's very difficult. But you're dealing with, you know, people being able to gain access to information of what's even going on. And I don't even think that we get to that step of people getting the information that they need to adequately participate, to be informed and to adequately participate. A public comment period just doesn't cut it when, you know, they may have other concerns, but that comment period is on something very specific that doesn't address the bigger problem. And so I think that we tend to fall short when it comes to those opportunities. And like the other gentlemen have been mentioning, this energy is often going somewhere else. It's just kind of passing through, or it's being extracted in an area. But there's a lot of pressure to, you know, keep energy production up. And so I think that a lot of these communities are often sacrificed in the process. But, you know, yes, opportunities are in place, but are they adequate? No.
Are there successful examples? I mean, maybe they're rare, but are there things we should strive towards?
Yeah, there was one example of, so when the U.S. Department of Energy was trying to create the first near-zero coal-fired power plant in Mattoon, Illinois, this was one of those projects where they were actually going door to door, knocking on doors within the community to try to determine, you know, whether or not they would be willing to have this project in their town. And there was a lot of incentives, including the fact that the Department of Energy was willing to pay a good chunk of the creation of that facility, but also, you know, opportunity for jobs and the fact that it was, you know, touted as something that would be environmentally safe. And so I think that was one of the situations where they were very accepting, but this community was, you know, used to industry. And so the fact that there was a cleaner industry possibility was something that was great to them. And so there was a lot of community support. The project later fell through, so Mattoon, Illinois is not the first near-zero power plant. But that was a success in that they really worked to get the community fully involved and provide them with cost-benefit analysis.
All right, we've all talked a lot. I want to hear some of the questions that have been submitted by our audience, and they're going to be read by our project editor, Rachel Ward.
This question is for Jim Stapleton. Did we hear correctly that smart grids may be only 4 to 5 years off? Can residential users request or promote acceleration of this in some way?
I think we'll see. There's been smart grid pilots. National Grid has successfully got a smart grid pilot in Massachusetts moving forward. We are working on it here in New York. I would say that smart grid's probably 5 years away as far as pilots and starting out looking at a lot of people. And I firmly believe that energy efficiency, once we get saturated with people doing lighting and a lot of things, that energy efficiency is the segue to smart grid. And without energy efficiency, there would be no smart grid. And without smart grid, energy efficiency will kind of phase out, and smart grid will be the things where we will be able to manipulate and control things through customers, through customer decisions, and through technology and through the utility infrastructure. So there's a lot of things that are going, and I think personally that it might be more 7 to 10, but I think we're getting in there. I think in the next 5 years, you're going to see we've already been successful. A lot of states are moving forward on smart grid. It does work. We've seen it work. It's just it comes down to is what is the cost to the ratepayer? Okay, when we look at these things, because somebody has to pay for the ability to do all of this. So if you've got a very small participation in these types of things, but you've got an infrastructure that needs to be smart grid ready, the question then becomes is, are we willing to increase energy costs for all of us so we have smart grid capabilities, and how do we find ways to do it more efficiently? But I do think that it's just around the corner.
We have a follow-up to that question about net zero. One of the members of our audience here has a net zero home and asks why we don't enable or help more people to be net zero and to actually make the energy they need on site.
I think we've done some of that. If you look at the net metering laws in the state of New York, net metering basically is there's generation on site at somebody's home. It can be in solar, wind, and we've done it for farms and some composting applications. And the net metering tariffs are getting, I'll say, better and better, more in favor of the ratepayer, meaning that you can have generation on your site. You use what you use. We have a bidirectional meter. What is not used gets put on the grid, and the customer is paid a market price for the energy. So I think that's a step in the direction. If you go to our website, powerofaction.com, we actually have some information on net metering there. If you Google New York State net metering, you'll find more than enough information. But that is something that is going in the right direction to basically serve yourself and give back to the grid.
This is actually more a statement for comment from the panel. The golden rule exists today. He who has the gold makes the rules. The relationship between big business and Washington seems to preclude the possibility of anything more than token advances in renewable resources. Your thoughts?
I'll give it a shot. I really think that's when I look at my involvement with the regulators, it's really at a from an overall demand side, it's really with the state regulators. And I think that clearly the Public Service Commission has the ratepayer in mind to say what is the most prudent expenditures for ratepayer money with these programs. So if you look at the programs that the utilities have, you know, if you take away a tax credit or a subsidy, the programs need to prove cost effective in their screening. So bottom line is most of our programs deal with traditional building systems. It's lighting. 50% of our programs deal with lighting. We have HVAC, we have heating, we have compressed air systems, we have energy management systems in homes, we have lighting and weatherization and that kind of thing. Most of the programs today, because they're not proving totally cost-effective yet, we don't have a lot of renewable dollars available because they're not screening where they need to be. So the point I guess I want to make is that I think your state regulators have clearly your interest when they do these programs, and they put the utilities and NYSERDA through some tremendous rigor trying to put forth cost-effective programs for the ratepayers in New York. So I can't speak to it on a federal level, but I certainly think in New York today, the programs that are out there are solid, and I think they will continue to evolve into more renewable opportunities that are incentivized.
I'm just going to step in. I'm not in the electric power industry, but and I think because of that, I can speak a little bit more freely. So I work on climate policy a lot, and I would say that roughly speaking, the electric power sector is not the problem. In the run-up to the Waxman-Markey bill in 2009, the largest organization of investor-owned electric utilities was basically on board with that program. With the Waxman-Markey bill, would have instituted a cap-and-trade system for carbon emissions and made a very meaningful reduction in the growth of U.S. carbon emissions. And electric power companies know that they have to do this sooner or later. They can read the writing on the wall. They build very, very long-term projects, 40 years and more. And they don't want to be stuck with white elephants, you know, building some power plant that, you know, in 5 or 10 years is suddenly going to be too expensive to operate. They also know that their costs are eventually going to end up, as Jim put it, in the hands of ratepayers, right? They know that any regulations that are imposed on them will eventually have their costs passed on to customers. So if there are people blocking this, I would say it is not the power industry. The power industry would love to have more certainty about climate policy.
I agree with that statement. Where I've seen some blockages, and you know, at first to me sounded kind of strange, but after a while thinking about it makes sense. But when you have, you know, the oil and gas industry investing a lot of money, say, in carbon capture and storage technologies, which would allow them to stay viable in a low-carbon world, but at the same time, they're also putting a lot of money into lobbying against climate change legislation. It seems a little twofold. It's one of those things where you're like, why are you playing both games? But in one respect, it allows them to continue business as usual, but on the other side, by kind of investing in these technologies, when we finally get to the point where we do have climate legislation in place, they're going to be ahead of the game and able to adapt quicker than some of the other companies that are just purely fighting it. And so I'm witnessing some of these strategies taking place.
Yeah, just to clarify this, right, I was sticking up for the electric power sector because they're selling electric power, which can be made in different ways, some of which are climate friendly. The oil companies sell basically one product, which produces carbon emissions, right? For them, it's not the same game as it is for power companies. Their product is the problem, and they have not covered themselves in glory in the debate, let's put it that way.
That is an excellent segue. We are just about out of time, but we're going to put some more of these answers to these questions on our site, innovationtrail.org. I'd like to thank everyone who contributed to our innovation conversation. Innovation Trail is a collaboration of NPR member stations led by WXXI in Rochester, along with WNED in Buffalo, WRVO in Syracuse and Oswego, WSKG in Binghamton, and WMHT in Albany. We cover issues related to technology, business, and the economy. The Innovation Trail's editor is Rachel Ward. Fred Vigent is executive producer of tonight's program. Audio engineering from Mark Lavonier and Adam Wolf. Additional assistance comes from Kate Rafty and Gina Clausen. Thank you to our guests, Andrea Feldpausch-Parker of SUNY ESF, Jim Stapleton of National Grid, and Pete Wilcoxon of Syracuse University. You can hear and see more stories about the green and tech economy at our website, www.innovationtrail.org. Support for the Innovation Trail comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from SUNY Oswego and the staff at the Metro Center in downtown Syracuse. From WRVO in Syracuse, I'm Emma Jacobs. Thanks for listening.